The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Yes, Evan Ní Chuilín is with me for the Thursday interview this week, the Fine Gael Senator. How are you?
I'm good, Kieran. Thank you very much.
Have you gotten used to people calling you Senator, addressing you as Senator yet?
No, I walk into work every morning and the ushers are some of the nicest people you'll ever meet. And good morning, yeah. Senator. Good morning, Senator.
Are there people who you knew before your life as a Senator who have adjusted?
No, nobody has adjusted in my private life. No.
And no respect, Ivan. That's the problem,
Kieran. I was up in the GAA club at the weekend and some of the members up there were kind of, you know, what do we call you now? And do we curtsy or do we bow or what do we do? So there's an awful lot of that. But sure, that's Ireland. Isn't it?
It is. Look, the obvious question is where we'll start. Why did you make the decision?
The decision was made very quickly. And it wasn't something that I was expecting. You know, this came, this phone call came out of the blue for me. But what Fine Gael couldn't have known and what others can't have known is how ready I was, I suppose, for the next challenge that I wanted for my career. I'm the type of person who will always look for more challenges than what's already on my plate.
Yeah.
And it can be detrimental to lots of things, including domestic life. But even when I was in RT and I was there for 20 years, I always had something else to distract me, you know, to challenge me outside of what I was doing. And that's not to say I wasn't challenged in my job. I'm just like that. I always have projects on the go. The last time I spoke to you was when I released my book.
Yes, right.
So, you know, I would have done that, you know, in my inverted commas spare time. I made a documentary a couple of years previous to that on the history of adoption in Ireland. And that was another kind of passion project that I would have worked on. But 10 years ago, I went back to college and did a master's part time over 2 years. Now, I was, you know, I had a toddler, I was pregnant, I had a newborn. It was an insane 2 years. But it was something I wanted to do because while I had a degree and a postgrad in journalism and communications and media and Irish, I wanted to bulk it up a little bit more with the management and the policy and governance side of sport.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. And I had a great 2 years in UCD. I loved going back to college. I just loved it. And I was lucky I had like a 6 month maternity leave block in there. Now I did have a newborn, but I loved going back and learning. And I wrote a thesis on trust restoration in the corporate governance of elite sport. And when I wrote that and handed it in, I actually handed it in the day before I flew to the Olympics for the Rio Olympics.
Oh,
and then
yeah.
I got out there and Pat Hickey got arrested.
Yes.
And I remember thinking, oh, here's my thesis. This is how you restore the Olympic Council. It was a bit of a full circle moment. But I do remember thinking, OK, I'm having kids. You know, I'm really busy and I love my job crucially. Like that was the job I loved. But I remember thinking, OK, well, I have this feather in my cap. I will come back to it. And I always thought I'd come back to it in a governance you know, role or policy,
yeah,
like Sport Ireland or any of the federations. You know, I have a lot of people in that industry that I look up to.
Yeah.
And I thought that's where I'd end up. So when the call came, even though I was, you know, I'd really enjoyed working on the Olympics and Paralympics just last year, and I was due to do the Women's Euros in the summer. So even though I was in a really good space, I had done 2 decades.
Mm.
The call came, I had already identified sport governance and policy as an area I'd like to work in. And I just thought, you know what, this could be a really great opportunity for me. And it's an enormous honour to get a call from Simon Harris, you know, at the end of the day.
And did you ask him why he called? What made him? Because as you said, the very first thing you said is he couldn't have known. So what was in his mind, do you think?
Well, the first approach came from John Paul Phelan, but literally the next day Simon rang me. So he wouldn't have rang me if he didn't, you know, want me to come in, I suppose. And I did ask him that, you know. I said, look, I'm really passionate about certain things and I do feel like I could, you know, do some good work. But I was asking him then, why, from your point of view, would you like, you know, somebody like me to come in? And he basically said that he had, you know, he had seen some of the stuff that I had done on the outside, you know, in terms of advocacy or just being outspoken on certain issues. And I have been on, you know, women's health or various things like and suicide. And I don't want to just go back to negative things, but I do. I have always, if I have challenges or struggles, I have tended to, as somebody with a public profile, I have tended to come out and talk about them because I do feel like it does make other people feel less isolated if they can see somebody else going through the same thing. So I had come out on a lot of issues. Irish language is a very, you know, public passion of mine, and so is women in sport. And those were the kind of things that he spoke about when he said that he would like me to come in and, you know, I suppose be impactful in those areas. And that's why I suppose I am the spokesperson for sport in the Seanad and arts and communications.
And on top of all that, I know you talked about your brother as well in the the Shannad and, you know, the advocacy work you want to do in the Shannad, kind of in that space, and the change you want to bring about. So for people who didn't hear it, maybe just tell me about him, first of all.
Yeah, well, I suppose now it's about more than advocacy. Like, it was, you know, when I didn't have any, you know, not power, but, you know, voice, that it's, you know, in the Shannad, there's a louder voice, I suppose, than outside of the Shannad. So now it's about actually trying to deliver on some of the priorities that I wanted to identify. So the background to it is my brother Cormac, 2 years younger than me, best friends when we were growing up, and Cormac would have struggled from about the age of 11 or 12, just with mental health, demons, things that were in his head. And he really struggled with that. And what happened was he self-medicated from a very young age and ended up in addiction. So by the age of 16, he would have been in treatment, residential treatment in Ashlin, in Ballyragget in Kilkenny, and really great centre. He was in and out of a lot of addiction centres in his life. He was in Ashiree, he was in the Rutland. I even went into Ashiree for a week for a family programme to try and best understand what he was going through. So he had a very supportive family. Mum and dad would have turned over every rock trying to get treatment for him and trying to get help. But unfortunately, he had a dual diagnosis, which basically means that, you know, he was in addiction and he also had a mental health illness. And you know, traditionally, you can't get into a treatment centre for addiction if you're on drugs for mental health. And if you have a mental health crisis, they won't let you into an emergency, an A&E or a hospital if you are not clean, in inverted commas. And Cormac actually tried to do that. He tried to check himself into one of the mental health hospitals a few weeks before he died, and they couldn't take him because he wasn't clean, and he took his own life a few weeks later. So that's a huge problem. The dual diagnosis and the treatment of it is an enormous problem. So I raised it. It was my first speech in the Shannad, and that was quite deliberate, just because I really wanted to honour Cormac. But I will be looking for, and it's something that's been raised today in the Shannad as well, because we have statements on mental health and suicide prevention. I will be looking for, you know, clinical nurse specialists in dual diagnosis in community settings, because again, it's not just a Dublin problem. It's not just an urban problem. Mm. It's a community problem everywhere. And then the other side of that, I actually went out to visit the Coolmine Treatment Centre, which is a fantastic facility. And I got quite upset out there because I really just wished Cormac had had the chance to go there. It's an amazing programme.
Yeah.
And they do have a holistic way of treating people. And it's a much longer program than he ever got access to. In terms of recovery, it's very hard to deal with anything in 6 weeks. This is a 24-week program, and it really looks at the whole human, and the Women's Centre has space for their children to come and live there with them while they recover. And then it has the other side of it, the psychiatric side of it as well, which means it's treating the dual diagnosis piece. So some people in that treatment centre do actually have medication and are allowed to take their medication for their mental illness, which, you know, this is the ideal utopian scenario, but unfortunately it's not replicated. They have a sister organisation in Limerick, but, you know, not that many places.
It's because when I heard you talking about it in the Shannad, it resonated with stories we often hear on this show in a different area of life, but still the kind of health space, which is kids who try to access the child and adolescent mental health services, but they've also got an autism diagnosis. Yeah. So then CAMHS turn around and say, well, no, the kid's autistic. You got to go to disability services. Disability services say autism's not the issue here. The issue is suicidal ideation or something like that. You got to go back to CAMHS. And these parents, what I thought of when I was listening to you was, the parents I speak to were probably the anguish your parents went through as well. To an extent, you know, you were old enough at that stage to be kind of absolutely conscious of what was happening. How just frustrating it must be to know that the help is there, but because of the way it's been structured, you can't access it.
Yeah, it's the peace and, you know, it's the silos and it's the lack of joined up thinking, and it can be quite frustrating. So that's another conversation that needs to happen, and they actually are happening, but it's very, very, very frustrating. I had a nurse after I spoke in the Shannad. I actually had a nurse from Kilkenny ring me up and say that she was, you know, a trained psychiatric nurse and that she wanted to be a clinical nurse specialist in dual diagnosis in Kilkenny. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. Somebody, the will is there.
Yeah.
The qualifications are there. The need, let me tell you, is definitely there.
Yeah.
But she said to me, crucially, there isn't a role there. There isn't funding for a role there. And so that's why I'm kind of, you know, trying to beat that drum. But she also said, Ivan, you know, the situation in the 12 or 13 years since you lost your brother, it's not gotten any better. It possibly has gotten worse. And if he was still alive, we still wouldn't be able to help him. So that's really hard to hear.
Yeah.
Because that just makes me think of the amount of people who we've lost even since Cormac died that have gone through something similar. That's why I got upset in Coolmine, because I really felt, Wow. And I talked to so many of the people out there. I got a tour. The tour that I got was not by, you know, clinical people or anything. It was from the people living there, going through treatment. And it was wonderful to talk to them and walk around with them. But the man who showed me around, the men's centre, just looked like Cormac. And I've kept getting a lump in my throat because he just reminded me of Cormac so much. And I just kept thinking, wow, I actually said to him, I really hope you're so proud of yourself because you've come so far. I really do wish that Cormac would have had that opportunity. And that's why I feel so strongly about how much we need to do. But also there is a model there. Can we try and replicate it elsewhere? Because imagine the amount of people that it would actually help.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know, is that something that gives you kind of sucker or a degree of optimism, or is it compound the frustration that we don't have to reinvent the wheel?
A little bit of both, actually. A little bit of both. While it's frustrating, and obviously I'll never get Cormac back, but I do remember the years that he was unwell, and it was 15 years of family life that was in, you know, in turmoil. And I'm talking about, you know, my parents didn't go on holidays in case something happened at home. And if they did, if they were away for the night, like, you know, anything could happen. I remember them getting a phone call because Cormac was, you know, God love him, he was going through a psychotic incident and he was doing, you know, he was driving the car in an erratic way or something. I don't know. But there were certain things that happened over the years that we all felt like we'd never get through it and there'd never be a breakthrough. And while we don't get Cormac back, some people going through that now, there is actually ways and people understand better how to help people in that scenario.
Yeah.
So hopefully it will make a difference.
To what degree have you gotten your feet under the desk in terms of actually implementing change? Because you can do, you know, you're quite right to say it's not advocacy anymore. You're actually a policy maker.
Yeah.
So how have you found that process? I know it's kind of taken a while for this doll to get up and running and committees are only getting up and running now, and I guess the business of government only getting up and running. But how have you found the receptiveness or otherwise of that message?
First of all, like, I can't believe, and maybe this is very naive, I can't believe how nice everyone is and how welcoming everyone was. I think the Shannon is probably an awful lot more collaborative than the doll. And so I think it was a nice entry for me, you know, coming from one livelihood into another.
Yeah.
So it has been a good transition. If you're talking about how I'm finding trying to affect change, I'm still learning, and obviously the committees are not even really up and running fully yet. We had our first meeting of the Sport Oireachtas Committee yesterday, but the other ones are not up and running yet. I am working away in the background though, because again, I can't sit still, I'm not able to. So I have been kind of having, you know, meetings, and like I said, I've been out to Coolmine. So I'm trying to come up with, you know, shaping some sort of like policy paper on various issues that I want to affect change on. One of the things, and the other kind of key priority for me, is actually, you know, young people and physical literacy and movement. And the way I'm looking at it is I'm looking at the programme for government and I'm looking at ways that we've said we are going to, you know, fix things or help people to, you know, better affect things. So one of the things that I'm looking at is there is a commitment there to provide 60 minutes of movement for children in school every day. And, you know, lots of schools are fantastic, but I do think it depends on your teacher and it can depend on your principal whether or not that's kind of implemented or encouraged. Loads of schools are doing great things, you know, like, you know, they, some of them run around, you know, they do a mile a day, or, you know, they do the kilometre or whatever. I know Helen McIntyre had the skip-a-thon challenge there quite recently, and all of these things really help, but it's not in the curriculum. So I think we need to look at why what the barriers are to that. One of the ones that I feel really strongly about is I think every child should wear a tracksuit every day. Like, if we're asking children to move for 60 minutes, would you do it in a shirt and tie and a skirt and Doc Martens, or, you know, little shoes with no laces? And I spoke to teenage girls at an event I was at last week for Dublin City. It was during Bike Week, and there was a panel discussion with five or six teenage girls about cycling. And they were asked, you know, what the barriers are to, you know, recreational cycling.
Yeah.
And sure enough, long uniform skirts was one of them. But I would argue short uniform skirts are even worse because, unless you're wearing bicycle shorts underneath. And in fairness, my daughter is 9 and she has worn, and I'm going to get her in trouble now because she just won't wear it, but she's worn the skirt once this year, and that was to sing in the choir at the mass for the communion or whatever it was. And she wore shorts underneath. So she just
my daughter
refuses.
She has to wear bicycle shorts underneath. Mm.
But you see, my daughter refuses to wear it. She just wears the tracksuit, and because I feel so strongly about it, I don't actually make her wear it.
Yeah, okay.
But now, so far, she hasn't got in trouble. But it's not, she's meant to wear it on PE days.
That's the senator
senator's daughter. We better not give out.
No, but lots of kids are the same. I do feel, though, in fairness, if you think about it practically speaking, if you wanted to work out, or not even work out, but go for a 60-minute walk or do squats or do skipping or lunges, yeah, you want to be in your tracksuit. So yeah, I do think it's an easy win. And I do think that most schools would be quite receptive to, you know, to that. We spend so much money on childhood obesity every year.
Yeah.
And we can't fix that this year, but we can prevent it in 10 years' time. We can, if we look at what we're doing with children now, we can actually look at it. And I know, I was raised by two teachers. I know schools and teachers get an awful lot of things thrown at them that is outside of their remit. So it's not that I'm asking teachers to take this on. That's not it at all. It's not their fault. It's not their job. But if we have access to children for 5 hours a day, and we've said in the programme for government we want them to move for 60 minutes, then I don't know, maybe we need to engage with, you know, the curriculum, yeah, and make sure that we are prioritising that.
Do you think the Camogie Association will see sense this week?
I really hope that the people who have a vote listen to the players who don't have a vote.
Yeah.
It's really important that vote gets over the line. I think there's an awful lot of reputational damage done in the last couple of weeks because this could have been prevented, could have been avoided.
Yeah.
I know that the rule book has to be followed. I get that. I have a master's in sports governance, but there was a rule there, I think it's 17.4, where they could have derogated 2 weeks ago. They could, yes, have avoided all of these protests. They could have avoided the cancellation of a match. They could have avoided the question marks that the Kilkenny players were asking themselves on Tuesday night of training. They could have taken all those decisions away from players, derogated for a year.
Yeah.
They could have derogated for a year, Kieran, and voted in 2026 as per, you know, Brian Molloy's suggestion, which was a great suggestion. But they didn't. So now the vote has to pass on Thursday and it needs a two-thirds majority because it was defeated in 2024. Yeah. So that's really tricky because it's the same people who voted last year. So we now need players and county boards and clubs to lobby delegates, because we can't have a situation whereby delegates say, well, nobody asked me to vote that way and I feel this way.
Yeah.
We can't be there on Friday morning next week. I just think it's going to get so much worse for the association. I am really disappointed the Irish Juror hasn't come out. I do think if it was the GA or the FAI or anybody else, the CEO would be out in front and speaking, yeah, and, you know, talking to the media, leading from the front. That's somebody who's paid in Croke Park. Brian Molloy is a volunteer at the end of the day. Munster Council delegates are volunteers. Yeah. And Camogie struggles with numbers. Camogie struggles with volunteers to put up nets and sit on county boards. And I'm worried now about that kind of volunteer spirit, because so much damage has been done by all of this controversy, and it was avoidable.
Yeah. Did anybody speak to you, and maybe it was John Paul Field, maybe it was Simon Harris or somebody else, about the realities of the job in terms of what you can achieve? So, you know what, this, I don't know who said it, you know, politicians always at the start, they overestimate what they can do in a year, but they underestimate what they can do, what change they can implement over 10 years. You know, they want to go in and they think they can do things overnight, and then there's this immediate frustration. Actually, God, you know, the wheels really turn slowly here. But then over time, I guess they learn, actually, you know what, there's a value in them turning slowly, and it leads to maybe slower incremental change, but it's more profound change. And I wonder, did anyone kind of talk to you about what you can realistically do? You listed a lot of things you want to do there.
I know I did. I know. And it sounds so naive. Nobody did actually sit me down and say that to me. However, I'm a journalist. I'm a trained journalist. I sat and I reported on Oireachtas committees,
when
sports organisations were in. So I have a fair idea of the legislative process. I would have watched a lot of the Shannon debates when the bill for adoption was going through, because I was doing the documentary at the time.
Yeah.
So I kind of understand the process. I kind of understand the limits. But I am still new, so I have a lot of zeal, and hasn't been knocked out of me yet.
The zeal of the reformer. Anyway, listen, it's been great. Evandy Quillen, Senator Evandy Quillen, thanks a million for joining us.
Thanks, Kieran.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.